call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:31 p.m. Wednesday, February 28th. We're in the Betrovich Room in room 205 here in the Capitol. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Members present today are Vice Chair Von Imhoff, Senator Giesel, Senator Schauer, Senator Begich, myself, Senator Wilson. This afternoon, we'll return to SB 173, Licensed Mobile Intensive Care Paramedics, presented by Senator Reback. On February 17th, we heard an overview of this bill. We took public testimony, and we received an updated fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services. The bill sponsor provided a lot of information on the audit process. Is there any final questions for the bill sponsor at this time? Seeing none, are there any amendments? Seeing and hearing none? Hearing none, is there a motion to move this bill from committee? Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I move Senate Bill 173, version 31-LS1365-M, from committee with individual recommendations and updated fiscal notes.
Is there objection to move this bill from committee? Seeing and hearing none, SB 173 is moved from committee. We'll take a quick ID to sign the paperwork and transition to the next item. Bill 134, Medicaid coverage for licensed counselors, presented by myself, Senator Wilson, on February 21st. We heard an overview of the bill. We took public testimony on this bill. At this time, as a quick follow-up, just a quick refresher, we have a couple of folks here in the room that would like to testify on this bill. First, we'll ask Mr. Wallace if he would like to come up and provide a quick overview and testimony of his facility and how this bill may be beneficial. And then we'll hear from, just put yourself on the record and take a few minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Wallace. I'm the CEO of Mat-Su Regional Medical Center in Palmer, Alaska. Mat-Su Regional is a 125-bed acute care hospital in the fastest growing service area in Alaska. I mention our size to you today because just a year ago, we were a 74-bed hospital. We did a 35-bed med-surg expansion, taking us to 109 beds. And then just last month, we expanded by adding a 16-bed behavioral health unit and took us to our current 125-bed licensure. And I appreciate working with the state through the licensure on that. This issue of Medicaid coverage for licensed professional counselors is an important one to us because it represents part of the continuum of care for behavioral health. As you know, the lack of behavioral health services available in our area as well as throughout the state is an important issue for us all to be concerned with, and we would like to have the care provided at the most appropriate level. We support Senate Bill 134 because if more counselors are able to be paid to see Medicaid patients with behavioral health needs, it will keep these patients from going to a higher, more expensive level of care, and in our case, overutilizing our emergency department. We feel that this will be better for everyone. The patient will receive treatment in an environment that is exclusively meant for their needs, and it will relieve stress on our already overtaxed emergency department, the physicians, the nurses, the other staff members, the patients and their families. It will also save the state money. We are currently working with our partner, the Mat-Su Health Foundation, to reduce the overuse of emergency department through things like their high utilizer Mat-Su project, or HUMS. This project targets patients who have used the emergency department at least 5 or more times in a year. As you know, 68% of these patients are Medicaid recipients, and a majority, if not all of them, are suffering from a primary or secondary diagnosis related to behavioral health. And I know my counterparts with the foundation have talked to you and sent letters and testified to the fact that we are saving money through this program. The number of patients served is still relatively small, but a small number of patients overutilizing the emergency department is too much, and we estimate that over $1 million has been saved by reducing the number of ER visits related to this population. If there are more counselors who will see our behavioral health patients in the community, just think about the potential savings to the state and the Medicaid services. In addition to these savings, I want to share another benefit. We have a counselor that we have had on staff for 5 years now. She works in one of our primary care clinics, and she's been waiting patiently to be able to see Medicaid patients. Overall, our population, 60% of our population that comes to the emergency department has a behavioral health diagnosis and would benefit from counselors, psychiatrists, and other healthcare providers. But without having this important payment mechanism, she cannot see Medicaid patients. So in conclusion, we support Senate Bill 134. We think it adds an important piece to the continuum of care, and we would ask that this move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. Any questions? Thank you. This time we'll go to your counterpart with the Health Foundation, Ms. Elizabeth Ripley. Ms. Elizabeth, are you with us on the phone?
Good afternoon, Senators Wilson and Von Imhoff, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Elizabeth Ripley, and I serve as the Chief Executive Officer for the Mat-Su Health Foundation. The foundation shares ownership in Mat-Su Regional Medical Center and invests our share of the profits back into the community in order to measurably improve the health and wellness of Alaskans living in Mat-Su. I am testifying today in support of Senate Bill 134, which will allow licensed professional counselors to bill Medicaid for their services. This bill is crucial because it will help to address an important health issue facing Mat-Su residents every day, mental health and substance use disorders. Licensed professional counselors are key behavioral health providers who can offer counseling and support for these problems. We know these are prominent issues for Mat-Su residents because they told us this in the last three Mat-Su community health needs assessments that we conducted. In our first one in 2013, residents and professionals said that the top five health challenges they face are alcohol and substance abuse, children experiencing trauma and violence, depression and suicide, domestic violence and sexual assault, and lack of access to behavioral health care. These are all issues that can be helped by residents seeking counseling. Senate Bill 134 would expand the workforce who can provide this counseling to residents who have Medicaid. Mat-Su school nurses tell us they see waiting lists as long as 4 to 8 months long for children and families with Medicaid to get in to see a counselor. We have trained and skilled licensed professional counselors in communities across Mat-Su that could see these children and others, but they aren't because they can't get paid for their services. The prevalence of mental health and substance use disorders and crises is increasing in the Mat-Su and statewide. The average annual growth rate for visits to the Mat-Su Regional Medical Center Emergency Department by patients with a behavioral health diagnosis grew 20% from 2015 to 2017 due to the opioid epidemic and lack of treatment access. As Dave Wallace, CEO of Mat-Su Regional, just shared, we now have an inpatient unit up and running, but previously the hospital provided no behavioral health treatment for this growing population. Passage of SB 134 could bring the appropriate level of care to people who need help when a problem first starts, instead of after it develops into a crisis. It is crucial to make sure that our residents have access to behavioral health providers so they are able to get this care early, before problems escalate to a crisis stage. Mat-Su Regional Medical Center is inundated by residents who are in crisis related to behavioral health problems. By example, in 2016, 3,443 residents were seen in the emergency department with a primary behavioral health diagnosis, and those 3,443 people had 8,400 visits. 46% of them were on Medicaid. The top diagnoses were suicidal ideation and self-harm, alcohol-related disorders, delirium, dementia, and cognitive disorders. The costs for those visits was $43.8 million in facility charges alone. This does not include the costs associated with law enforcement or emergency transportation. The average charge per visit was $5,216, and the average cost per patient was $12,725. Clearly, the emergency department is the least cost-effective place to treat behavioral health problems. If we can intervene early with a system where all residents can get more immediate access to a behavioral health provider, we can save a ton of pain and suffering as well as money. An individual session for Medicaid is $75, while an average charge per behavioral health emergency department visit is $4,370. Granted, an individual needs more than one visit early on to prevent a crisis, but even if you paid for 10 visits at $750, you would be saving $3,600. However, access remains a problem. Very few primary care practices employ behavioral health providers. The example that Dave Wallace just shared of Solstice is unusual. We know of two primary care practices in MATSU outside of our federally qualified health centers that employ a behavioral health clinician, two. There's lots and lots of primary care practices. But one reason that there is so little integration of behavioral health into these practices is that those providers can't bill Medicaid. Another reason was that there's so little integration was that there's a shortage of psychiatrists to supervise behavioral health providers. However, with the passage of SB 169 that allowed behavioral health providers to be supervised by any physician in 2018, and thank you for sponsoring that legislation, Senator Giesel, that particular barrier has been overcome. The next step is to have more behavioral health providers who can bill Medicaid, thus making the inclusion of behavioral health services sustainable in physician offices. And so this bill that you are hearing today, combined with SB 105 that allows Medicaid billing for marriage and family counselors that passed last session, will do just that. So we really have quite a number of the pieces falling into place to provide more upstream intervention for behavioral health care. Mr. Wallace mentioned our HUMS program, which we affectionately call HUMS, which stands for High Utilizer MATSU. We started this program as a way to provide care coordination and access to community supports for high utilizers, defined as residents who had five or more visits in the emergency system in a year and who were, for whatever reason, unable to independently access consistent, appropriate care and support in the community. Mr. Wallace mentioned the dramatic cost savings, which top $1.1 million a year per year. We're now entering our third year of the project. But it has also alleviated significant trauma for not only the patients it serves, but for the healthcare providers and families who often suffer trauma along with the patients. The current director of the HUMS program, Dr. Quimby, told me that when he took over for Dr. Zink, who's now the chief medical officer for the state of Alaska, he took it over as a favor to her, and he really didn't believe this was going to work. And he said, I'm a believer now. I'll talk about it to anybody. In fact, he said, I like coming to work more now because the patients I'm serving actually get help. So, again, if people had access to these care and supports before their needs became a crisis, before they presented to our emergency department, there would be far less need for a program like HUMS. You heard some of the data that Mr. Wallace shared. I'll add that we've topped $2.168 million in cost saving. We have, by the way, a third-party evaluator on this project. So we're not, we have an independent evaluator who's really tracking our progress and helping us course correct and learn along the way. In 2018, the top three utilizers alone saved $347,288 in ED charges. In that same year, we had seven patients who didn't use the emergency department at all after their enrollment in the program. And the age of our super utilizers ranges from 16 to 82. 72% had Medicaid as their health coverage. there are, you hear the data and you hear the cost savings, but I kind of wanted to share the human piece of the impact of the hums. And Dr. Quimby told this story at our annual meeting of the Health Foundation.
Ms. Ripley?
He said they had one client, a young adult, that had 17 visits to the emergency department in the previous year before rolling in hums. He had poorly managed his diabetes and had a substance use disorder, and most of his ED visits led to an inpatient admission in the intensive care unit at our hospital. The client had a long history of IV drug use and was non-compliant with primary care appointments, and in fact, as soon as he started feeling better, usually left the ICU against medical advice. When the case was referred to the HUMS program, the outlook was poor. In fact, the hospital staff believed this young man was going to die. The HUMS staff was told the client had little to no interest in improving his situation. But the HUMS team built a rapport with the client, and he did want to change. He did want a healthier life. We're happy to share that this client is now sober. His diabetes is well managed. He has a driver's license. He's working a full-time job, and he has a great relationship with his primary care provider. And he has years of life to be lived to make a positive difference, not just for him and his family, but for all of us who will benefit from his contribution. So that's just one example. The Mattsu Health Foundation is actively doing our part to complete
this
behavioral health continuum of care that's fully staffed with caring professionals.
Ms. Ripley?
We invest in our local nonprofits to help them scale their services. We provide scholarships and invested in Sharp 3 loan repayment. And we seat half the governing board of our hospital to create that behavioral health wing. So we appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer questions, and we're happy to work with you to get this bill across the finish line. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. One more quick, Mr. Christian. Person to provide some comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be very quick. For the record, my name is Jared Kosin. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. We think your bill is good policy and we support it. We constantly talk about how to lower the cost of care. This is how you do it. You invest in the continuum at the community level, where it is a lot cheaper, and you reserve those higher level, more expensive settings for people that actually need it. So all I want to leave you with is this. In talking to a CEO of a facility yesterday, this bill came up, and he said, this bill is a test. If this bill fails, we know where we stand, and if anyone cares about the behavioral health crisis before us, all hope is lost. I can assure you he was not being dramatic, and we believe this is a very practical step forward. We urge you to press your bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right. With that, is there any other final questions for the bill sponsor at this time? Seeing or hearing none. Is there any amendments? Seeing or hearing none. What is the will of the committee? Senator Von Imhoff?
I move Senate Bill 134, version 31-LS1216 /A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Any objection? Seeing and hearing none, we'll take a brief at ease and let the next presenter come up to get ready to present. Now we're going to turn to Senate Joint Resolution 13, Constitutional Amendment Prohibiting the Funding of Abortions by Senator Hughes. This is our first time hearing this resolution, so we'll hear an overview from the bill sponsor and take invited and public testimony. Just to let folks know that due to not having a meeting on Monday, we're sort of business stacked today, so hopefully we can try to get through as much of the testimony as we can. We probably won't be able to get through it all public testimony, so I urge folks, if they would like to send us an email, we've received over 30-something emails already at shss.alaska.gov, at alaska.gov, That will be preferred as well. Again, that also gets entered into the record, and that email address is shss@alaska.gov. With that, we'll let Ms. Senator Hughes and Ms. Hart go ahead and present this bill, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm very grateful for your scheduling and hearing this today. It's been a while since we've had this topic on the docket, and I know there's a lot of interest. My name is Shelley Hughes, and I'm the Senator for District F, and with me is my staffer, Lisa Hart. One thing I just want to make clear, the shortened title I want to read the longer title, which isn't really very long, but it's proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to abortion, so it doesn't specifically prohibit abortion. SJR 13 proposes an amendment to our Constitution, adding a new section that would provide clarity regarding Article 1, which specifically pertains to the right to privacy and the right to equal protection and Alaska's ability to set public policy related to abortion. As you know, the U.S. Supreme Court declared in Roe versus Wade, and that was in 1973, and reaffirmed again in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, that there is an alleged federal constitutional right to abortion. However, the federal courts have held that states can still legislate related issues in a number of ways, for example, by banning the use of public funds, requiring a parent to consent before abortion can be performed on a minor, and even disallowing certain abortion procedures, such as partial birth abortion or late-term abortion. In fact, in Minnesota, both parents must be informed before a minor can have an abortion. In Illinois, one parent must be informed. There are 37 states, mind you, including blue states, that have laws requiring parental notification, and 21 of those 37 actually require parental consent. Additionally, 21 states have laws in effect that prohibit partial birth abortion, and 3 have laws that apply to post-viability, that being the ability to survive outside of the womb. Blue states, and we'll see some maps later, but blue states such as California, Washington, Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and more prohibit abortion after the baby is in the womb, after the baby in the womb is 24 weeks old, and gray states, and I want to define gray states. Gray states are states that are competitively split as far as left versus right and Democrat versus Republican. And that's according to Gallup. So there are 3 gray states I want to point out that prohibit abortion when a baby is more than 18 to 22 weeks old. And those 3 gray states are Texas, Nebraska, and North Carolina. Then there are another 3 states just recently lean neither left or right, but according to Gallup, they passed heartbeat bills prohibiting abortion of babies at only 6 to 8 weeks. So in Alaska, we are unable to have any provisions in law related to abortion under our present Constitution, and I'm here today to ask you to help me fix our Constitution so some of the same parameters even blue and gray states have made could be allowed to stand if it is the will of the people and the will of Alaskans, either through their elected legislators, such as those of you in this room, as well as through the voter initiative process. Please allow me to remind those listening and to review the fact that in the past, legislation and ballot initiatives have indeed passed in our state, similar to the laws we just discussed that have been upheld, but in our state they've been struck down by our Alaska Supreme Court. These laws have passed related to abortion. They've gone through due process, but they've been overturned at the bench. They have been subject to a series of decisions asserting the existence of a state constitutional right to abortion that protects abortion more broadly even than the U.S. Constitution. And as a result, numerous laws that would be completely permissible under our federal constitution and exist in other states have been struck down by our courts. SJR 13 simply would allow Alaska to be on par with other states. It would permit the decisions that Alaskans make to stand, for example, regarding parents of minors, unborn babies, and public funding for abortion. We have seen a pattern of our state Supreme Court's obstruction in the lawful business of the legislature for too long. The bill is not designed to answer the question of what a woman may legally do or not do. This bill is not designed to tell the legislature they may not fund abortion in the future. This bill is designed to keep the courts from adding something to the state constitution that its framers never envisioned. Because the right to privacy has been the court's default to knock down abortion-related laws in Alaska, I'd like to point out to the committee that decades ago, when the legislature in this building passed a resolution to put the right to privacy on the ballot, and when Alaskans agreed with that amendment in the ballot box in 1972, it had nothing, I repeat, nothing to do with abortion. In fact, according to the Alaska State Constitution Citizens Guide by Legislative Affairs, which we probably most of us have in our office, it states, and I'm just going to read two sentences so it won't take long, Mr. Chair. The right to privacy was prompted by fear of the potential for misuse of computerized information systems, which were then in their infancies. So what was the impetus for that? In the early 70s, the Department of Public Safety was developing the Alaska Justice Information System, a computerized database of information on the criminal history of individuals. Fearful such a system was the precursor of Big Brother, government information bureaucracy, legislators responded with a constitutional amendment on the right to privacy. So you can see that was the beginning of the current concerns which that we refer to today as data mining. So I thought this history about the adoption of the right to privacy was a very important perspective for you to have as you consider this resolution, because that right to privacy was not at all related to abortion. This bill is really about protecting the separation of powers, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Andrew Kleinfel of Fairbanks, in a case entitled Compassion in Dying versus the State of Washington in 1995, made a very powerful and poignant statement. And I would like you to please listen very carefully and realize this is coming from a judge and not a legislator. Here's what he said. That a question is important does not imply that it is constitutional. The Founding Fathers did not establish the United States as a democratic republic so that elected officials would decide trivia and while all great questions would be decided by the judiciary. I'm going to repeat that again, the ending. Founding Fathers did not establish the U.S. as a democratic republic so that elected officials would decide trivia while all great questions would be decided by the judiciary. This bill, Mr. Chair, is about we the people, what parameters and what laws we want. It's about common sense. And even though I personally, one of our very most vulnerable Alaskans, unborn babies protected, and abortion to end, to be abolished, and I want at birth these precious Alaska children to be cared for and cherished by loving parents and families. And even though I, as a sponsor of this resolution, believe that one day Americans will look back on abortion like we do slavery, a barbaric act that has no place in a civil society. This constitutional amendment will simply allow Alaskans to decide what kind of policy we want in Alaska regarding abortion. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lisa has some additional remarks and some maps that we'd like to show you just to give you an overview of what is permissible in other states, and then she can go through a quick sectional. It's a very short resolution, as you wish, Mr. Chair.
Hello, Mr. Chair and the committee. Thank you very much for letting me be here today. My name is Lisa Hart. I am legislative staff to Senator Shelley Hughes. First, I would like to share just a couple of maps I put together, and I want to go ahead and refer to what the senator was saying about gray states, and this kind of gives you a little bit of a background on that. My objective with this map, or this page of maps here, is to just show that actions are being taken. Actions are being taken across the United States. And I wanted to just read real quick some notes that I have. In 2019, conservative state legislators raced to enact an unprecedented wave of bans in all, most, or some abortions. And by that end of that year, 25 new abortion bans have been signed into law, primarily in the South and Midwest. Along with this new strategy, legislators also continued their efforts to adopt other types of abortion restrictions, including requirements for abortion providers to give patients misleading and inaccurate information about the potential to reverse medication abortion, as well as abortion counseling. State-level policy developments to ban or restrict abortion are an important backdrop as the U.S. Supreme Court considers a Louisiana law in 2020, and I might add that we are fortunate to have Senator Katrina Jackson from the state of Louisiana as one of our invited testifiers today. To require that abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. There's a lot of different suggestions and different items here that I can read on, but my point to bring to you, Mr. Chair, and the committee, is that action is being taken by states to be able to take this matter into the legislative, the lawmaking body of the government, as opposed to being decided in a judicial review. So with that, I'd like to...
We can pause for a moment. We have a question. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lisa, you're categorizing this piece of legislation as the way that you're couching it is in terms of politics. You're making statements about politics. I'm looking at the map up here, and I see Alaska listed as a solid Republican state. And I mean, I'm curious, when you come up with these distinctions about politics, is that really the best way to frame an issue like this, where in the state of Alaska, say for example in the last gubernatorial election, the difference between the top two candidates was less than 5%, or the prior governor was actually not a Republican but a nonpartisan supported by the Democratic Party, or where the last U.S. senator for the state that there was a U.S. senator for the state from 08 to, you know, to 2014 that was also a Democrat. Is it really the right way to present this argument, as a partisan and as an argument about party, and is that helpful to the cause of this process?
Senator Hughes?
I'd like to answer that, if I may, through the chair, Senator Begich. I will take blame or credit, however you want to say. I don't see it as trying to introduce politics, partisan politics. The point of it is to make it clear that a spectrum of states have decided to put parameters we're unable to. I would actually say that the 2018 map, notice that's 2018, if we were to find the Gallup one, if we were to find that for 2020, Alaska would probably be gray. It was just to depict that it doesn't matter where anyone falls along the political spectrum, that there have been parameters set in various states. So it's not to pit anyone against another. In fact, Senator Katrina Jackson online is an African-American and a Democrat from Louisiana, and she led this in her state, so it's not partisan at all. It's in my mind, it's about the babies.
Ms. Hart?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to go ahead and, for the sake of time, give a quick reading of the sectional analysis for this bill.
Please do.
Thank you. SJR 13, Abortion Amendment, proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to abortion. Section 1, Article 1, Constitution of the State of Alaska, page 1, lines 3 through 7, amends the Constitution of the State of Alaska by adding a new section, Section 26, titled Abortion. This amendment states that in order to protect human life, nothing in this Constitution may be construed to secure or protect a right to an abortion or require the state to fund an abortion. Section 2, Article 1, Constitution of the State of Alaska, page 1, lines 8 through 10, adds that the amendment proposed by this resolution shall be placed before the voters of the state at the next general election in conformity with Article 13, Section 1, Constitution of the State of Alaska and the election laws of the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. With that, we're going to go to, does anyone have any additional questions for the bill sponsor at this time?
I will.
Yes, Senator Baggage.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Hughes, is there anything right now in our law that would prohibit somebody who chose not to have an abortion from making that choice? Is there anything that prohibits somebody from choosing to not have an abortion in our law today?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair. We do have the Department of Law on the phone for any specific questions regarding the legality, so I'll just mention that. But
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up.
Yes, please.
What I'm asking really is there any law that compels a person to have an abortion in the state of Alaska now? Or does a person have the ability to choose whether they will take a child to term?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Begich. A person is free at this point, although there are pressures and things that happen where I think that a mother and the baby doesn't have a choice. I will say the baby doesn't have a choice. But again, let's really focus on what is before us. It is not a piece of legislation that is going to take that choice away at this point. It is a piece of legislation that will allow this body and through a voter's initiative process to decide what kind of policy we want. We still are subject to what has been decided at the federal level at this point, even though I will say I don't agree with what's been decided at the federal level. Because I believe that just as a woman wants a choice, the very tiniest, littlest women, the little baby girls in a womb deserve the choice to live. But that's not what this is about. This is really about our ability to maximize what we can under the federal law at this point, which we are unable to at this time.
I have one follow-up.
Yes.
But so then what it does do is removes the coverage of Alaska's right to privacy in issues regarding abortion. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so that really, in issues regarding abortion, it potentially places, it, by removing essentially one gender from that coverage, don't you think that there's some level of unfairness in the removal of that one gender from the coverage of right to privacy when it comes to this issue? And I recognize your concern for those that haven't yet been born, but I'm talking about the gender that's specifically affected by this particular removal of the coverage of the right to privacy.
Actually, there are two genders involved, and we're going to get into a philosophical debate, but there's the gender of the little boy babies and the gender of the little girl babies. So, Senator Begich, with the chair's permission, I prefer kind of sticking to what the bill actually does rather than a philosophical debate. Offline, we can certainly have that philosophical debate unless it's the wish of the chair to have that discussion.
Well, in the interest of time, we do have a lot of folks who do want to get to the testimony. Will this bill be before us again for a couple other
times? I don't have any further questions.
Okay. I also just want to clarify the email address for comments. It's shss@akleg.gov. Again, that is shss@akleg.gov for folks to submit the written comments. Also, the graph presented will be uploaded to BASIS later on today. We're going to go to invite testimony. I believe Senator Jackson is on the phone. Ms. Jackson, if you want to put yourself on the record and begin your invited testimony.
Everyone hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon, colleagues. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Let me just say that I had an opportunity to visit your state late fall last year, and it is beautiful, and I had a wonderful time and was treated with so much care and respect that I almost felt like I was in Louisiana all but your cold weather. And so let me thank those who hosted me and just tell you guys you have a wonderful state. And I plan on bringing my family back to visit because they hadn't had an opportunity yet. So hopefully we'll boost the economy a little bit while we're there. I have nieces that love to shop. And so with that being said, I am calling in to testify because in our state we have legislated on a few of in a few of the areas where you have also legislated. The difference is, I believe, as I researched, that your state has, your court system, rather, has struck down most of the laws, one of which I looked at that was kind of alarming to me. I do believe that the legislature and also the Supreme Court believe that when they passed Roe versus Wade and a number of other cases, that each individual state legislature had an interest in regulating abortions and also protecting the health and safety of their constituency. We have parental consent laws, and as I understand it, some of your laws regarding parental consent have been struck down. What was most glaring to me, and I have this same legislation that went forth last year in our state legislature, and it passed, and it goes to a vote of the people during the presidential election this year. But what was most alarming when I see courts being able to strike down legislation that the U.S. Supreme Court clearly said that a state passed, and why I believe this constitutional amendment is necessary for your state as it is ours, is this. I also am preparing on tomorrow to file legislation for our upcoming legislative session regarding human trafficking and what the abortion facilities have to report. What records they will have to maintain, because new studies have come out. We had an incident in our state where we found out in Shreveport, a clinic about an hour and a half away from my hometown, that women were being brought across from the Texas lines and young girls and being human trafficked. The only way we were able to find that out is because we had a statute in place that dealt with parental consent. And so some that came in alleging to be parents, when the records, and these records are not public, so these are all private records. But what happens is when our Department of Health and, well, Louisiana Department of Health receives so many complaints regarding this, they can actually research it. And so at that point, it's a very private investigation between them and the clinic. Well, a lot of that was triggered based on our parental consent laws. And so when you can't pass things like parental consent laws and things of that nature, which go way outside of the right to abortion, then we kind of put ourselves in a box where we can't protect vulnerable young girls who are coming, you know, in and out of our state and unwillingly being taken to abortion clinics. So that was the first thing that was most glaring to me when I looked at what your Supreme Court had overturned, what Alaska, the Alaska legislature had passed. And so my concern is this. I am pro-life, and I'm always very upfront about that. But I'm also a practicing attorney. Didn't know if I was going to make this call because I was in court. But I've always promised that any law that I passed, I would do my best, and in my belief, if it was unconstitutional, I wouldn't author it. So sometimes there are certain situations that basically for human decency bear upon regulating any industry or any healthcare industry, right? And abortion is one of those industries that sometimes regulations must be put on. Right now what I'm seeing across the nation is that without these constitutional amendments, some states are never able to regulate abortion facilities and clinics and health standards of them at all. And so I'm encouraging state legislators, and I'm respectfully encouraging you. I know I don't represent your constituency, but I think that we all work together on different issues. I know we do, from National Conference of State Legislators and other conferences I visit, to really look at this as this protects your ability to take a vote when needed to regulate abortion facilities and to regulate human trafficking and other things that come up as it relates to that. And it's just a simple truth. All legislators do it in every other area of what some consider healthcare. I don't think that legislators' hands should be tied when there's a valid state interest in the health and safety of their constituents in regulating this area. And the Supreme Court didn't think so. But alarmingly enough, in your state and other states, we're constantly now seeing the courts rule against legislation passed, even if there's, you know, a compelling state interest. And so those are my comments. And admittingly, I'm pro-life, but saying to you that even if you're not pro-life, there are just some areas that are going to come up in health standards that we're going to have to regulate. And without this constitutional amendment, from my research across the country on what's happening to certain states, you're not able to regulate in that area. And that goes far beyond whether a woman has a right to an abortion. It goes into so many other areas of law.
All right. Thank you, Senator Jackson, for your testimony. Any questions for Senator Jackson? Seeing and hearing none, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for you guys taking the time. Thank you.
Next, we'll go to Dr. Donna Harrison. Dr. Harrison?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. If you want to state your name and put yourself on the record, you may begin.
Yes, Chairman Wilson, Vice Chair Von Imhoff, and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to address this committee in support of SJR 13. I'm Dr. Donna Harrison. I'm a board-certified OB-GYN, and I'm the executive director of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, representing over 4,000 reproductive health professionals throughout the United States. We practice in accordance with the Hippocratic Oath. Hippocratic medical professionals have vowed to do no harm to their patients and certainly not to intentionally kill them. We recognize both the pregnant mother and the human being in her womb as our patients. Now, you will hear testimony that elective abortion is necessary to a woman's reproductive health, but this is actually not true. 85% of OB-GYNs do not perform abortions as part of their professional practice, even though we're all trained to be able to separate a mother and her fetus at any gestational age. Why? Because elective abortion is not necessary for women's reproductive health. The purpose of an elective abortion is to produce a dead baby for social, not medical reasons. That was made explicitly clear during the testimony of the abortion providers at the partial birth abortion hearings before the United States Supreme Court. Abortion providers testified that the reason that they specifically killed the unborn human being during the partial birth abortion process is that they were paid to perform an abortion and not a delivery. And this distinction is critically important to understand. If an OB-GYN needs to separate the mother and her unborn human being in the womb in order to save her life or the life of her baby, and the baby is at the point where the baby could survive outside the womb, then an OB-GYN will do a delivery procedure, which is designed to maximize the chances of survival of both the mother and her unborn child. That's what an OB-GYN is trained to do. In contrast, an abortion done after a baby is capable of surviving outside the womb is done to guarantee that the human being in the womb does not survive the separation procedure, that is, will be killed before or during the separation procedure. In the case of a D&E procedure, the living human being is torn limb from limb, and the pieces are removed, and the baby then bleeds to death in the womb. In the case of an intact D&E, which is a partial birth abortion, the living human being is delivered to the point where his or her head is entrapped in the cervix, the opening of the womb, and then the baby's skull is pierced, and the baby's brains are sucked out with a suction catheter, which induces his or her death. And in the case of induction abortions, generally the baby is killed in utero, but occasionally these babies survive the feticide procedure and the induction. It's important to note that a baby who survives an induction abortion is called a, quote, failed abortion. The separation from the mother did not fail to occur. What failed to occur is that the baby failed to die. Now, it's true that rarely separation of the mother and the unborn human being in her womb must be performed before a baby is capable of surviving outside in order to save the mother's life. And a Hippocratic OB-GYN would perform that delivery in a way that would maximize the chances of the mother's survival and, if possible, provide the family with the dignity of an intact body of their child in order to provide that family with the opportunity to grieve their loss. This pre-viable separation procedure is not the same as an elective abortion. These separations are done in a hospital where the mother's other emergent medical needs can be addressed. But contrast this to an elective abortion, where the mother is sent to a hotel to deliver her fully formed and recognizable baby in a toilet, alone, with no one to address her needs. Elective abortions are, by definition, not medical care. They do not cure any disease. Pregnancy is not a disease. Pregnancy is a natural condition which is limited in duration to 9 months at the most. Disruption of that natural process carries serious short- and long-term risks for the mother. Some of the short-term risks include major hemorrhage, infection, anesthesia complications, damage to the mother's womb, and death. Long-term health risks include significantly increased risk of preterm birth in subsequent pregnancies, an increased risk in breast cancer if she aborts before she ever brings a pregnancy past 32 weeks gestation and matures her breast tissue to make milk, and an increased risk of suicide, drug abuse, and hospitalizable major depression. These are certainly public health considerations that the state of Alaska has reason to be able to regulate. And yet, under the current situation, the court that you have is not allowing for reasonable regulations in the interests of both the mother's health, not to mention the interests of the life of the fetus. All of these risks that I mentioned, I have referenced in the handout that I sent to you, my written testimony. And you can, and I would be happy to provide any more information if anyone on the committee would like that. But for all these reasons, it is reasonable for the state of Alaska to pass SJR 13 for the sake of the mother's health, not only for the sake of the being able to regulate in the interests of the unborn child. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Harrison. Next for invited testimony is Teresa Bokanovnik. Teresa, are you online?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. And I apologize for the butchering of your last name.
I really appreciate your time today. Hi, everyone. My name is Teresa Bokovnak. I am an atheist. I'm a liberal. I'm a feminist, a vegan, an LGBTQIA ally, a registered Democrat, and I'm also the founder and executive director of Pro-Life San Francisco. We're a millennial-led organization dedicated to resisting the influence of abortion in our community. I've come to you today humbly begging for your support of SJR 13, a bill that is crucial to ensuring equal representation for all Alaskans. As a full-time activist, I've seen and confronted similar bills across the nation. I've spoken with legislators across the U.S. asking the question, why is it so controversial to declare that there is no right to abortion, when after all, we're not calling for its criminalization, but simply keeping the door open for regulations? And the answer that I've gotten over and over again is this, that there are people who want to use this legislation as a way to ban all abortion. And I'm calling it out now because I'm pretty sure that's what is on a lot of your minds. And I'm here to tell you that, yes, you're right, of course, there are those who want to ban all abortion. Guess what? There are those who want to ban all birth control. There are people who think that sex before marriage should be a crime. Trust me, as a secularist, I understand. We can go down that rabbit hole, and it can get much worse. But I'm begging you to also consider this, perhaps something you haven't even thought about before or known. But there are hundreds and likely thousands of research projects happening across America right now that rely on fetal tissue. Now, you might be thinking, what is wrong with that? If there's going to be abortion, then at least the remains should go towards curing diseases, et cetera, et cetera. I get it. But this is how it works. Many of these projects require a monthly supply of multiple late-term pristine fetuses between the ages of 18 and 24 weeks from elective abortions, meaning they were not the result of rape or where the life or health of the parent or the fetus are in jeopardy. Fetuses after 22 weeks have a high likelihood of survival if given medical care. In order to procure tissue from a fetus, feticides like digoxin cannot be used because it compromises the tissue for research. So the only two methods that are available are a fully live dismemberment procedure or a medical induction which, according to the Society of Family Planning, a pro-choice organization, produces born alive infants up to 50% of the time. That is half. Okay, most Democrats do not support this. According to a 2019 Marist poll, 72% of Democrats want abortion more restricted than it is today. So tell me, where is our leadership? Your constituents want your leadership on this issue, but many have been shamed and stigmatized into silence. The vast majority of people are not trying to ban all abortion. They're trying to ensure that it is regulated, and they want there to be fewer of them. In the face of unrelenting pressure from the powerful abortion lobby, we must assert loudly the will of the majority that abortion up until birth is not a right. A more progressive world cannot be bought with tens of thousands of intentionally killed viable preborn babies. And we, the people, cannot protect them from an industry that seeks to profit from their demise without your support of SJR 13. Thank you so much.
Thank you. At this time, just want to remind folks, we probably won't be able to get through everyone that called in. I think there's over 100 folks signed up to testify, either in person or on the phone. We urge folks to send their written comments to shss@akleg.gov. We're going to work our way here through public testimony. We're going to ask folks for 2 minutes. Not to be rude to anyone, but if you're at the end of the 2 minutes, we'll try to wrap things up. But we will just go ahead and move on to the next person. So we'll try to get through this as quick as possible, and then we will look at another time next week to continue an opportunity for public testimony, not to try to disenfranchise anyone to speak. So with that, we're just going to try to take folks who called in first and folks here in the room in Juneau. So we're going to ask the sponsor to clear the table. As we first take folks here from the Anchorage LIO, we'll start with Lisa Gentleman. And public testimony is open.
Hello, my name is Lisa Gentleman, and I'm from Eagle River. Thank you for taking time to be attentive to my testimony. I'm here today to ask Alaskan legislators to support SJR 13. I'm a prior dental hygienist and science teacher. We must defend, protect, and speak up for the safety and rights of the unborn until they are able to defend themselves. Even before our constitutions, federal and state, were written, we were all given the unalienable right to life by our Creator, as is stated clearly in the Declaration of Independence. Our government was implemented to secure our rights, per the Declaration. The Declaration states that if a part of our government does not secure our rights, we have the duty to overthrow them. Due to the fact that some governmental officials, particularly in the judicial branch, are not following the Declaration of Independence and have wrongly taken the unalienable right, hopefully only temporarily, to life away, according to directions given to Americans by the writers and signers of the Declaration of Independence, we must, quote, take it upon ourselves in sacred honor, unquote, and declare our judges, quote, as unfit to rule in a free nation and remove them from power and instead institute officials who will defend the right to life and, quote, assent to the laws most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Please support true governmental leaders such as Senator Shelley Hughes, who are rightly following our Declaration of Independence and leading us in the right direction and striving to protect all Alaskans through SJR 13. It is a bill that will begin to help us rightly reclaim our unalienable right to priceless life. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to the off-net to former Lieutenant Governor Lauren Lehman. And plan for 2 minutes for your testimony. Mr. Lehman?
Can you come back to her?
To him.
To him.
Oh. He's there. Hello, Ms.
Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you now. If you want to put yourself on the record and plan for 2 minutes for your testimony.
Okay, thank you for inviting me to testify. I'm Lauren Lehman, and I think all of you know I served in the legislature for 14 years and as lieutenant governor for four. I support SGR 13 as a necessary step in restoring to elected officials and the people of Alaska the ability to set policy on abortion. Sadly, that authority has been usurped for more than two decades by a series of unfortunate court decisions. And my testimony, which actually I prepared longer than 2 minutes, but I'll try to abbreviate it, is my story. In 1997, I sponsored SB 24 to allow Alaska to enforce a law already on the books that required doctors to obtain parental consent before performing an abortion on an unemancipated minor girl. When Alaska legalized abortion in 1970, the law included a provision requiring, get this, parental consent before an abortion. But an attorney general's opinion said that was unenforceable, so the state stopped enforcing it. The bill I introduced provided what is called a judicial bypass, which allows a young girl to go to court to get permission instead of through a parent. And this was done in full compliance with the U.S. Supreme Court. At the time, the U.S. Supreme Court had even recently issued a 9-0 decision. Get that and think about who was on the court. 9-0 decision in a case from Montana that said, in effect, don't send us any more of these cases. We have already told you we approve parental involvement statutes with these provisions. So we passed the legislation with a strong supermajority, enough to override a veto from then-Governor Tony Knowles. But Planned Parenthood sued. It went to court. And in the court's decision, it was a 3-2 decision against the statute. Justice Dana Fabe wrote that is less restrictive, requiring only parental notification, would be acceptable. So we took her at her word,
and then
I joined two other Alaskans. We, with a citizen initiative, gathered the signatures, took it to the people, got more than 56% of the vote, and that became law and was in effect for several years.
Okay, Mr. Lehman.
Planned Parenthood again challenged the law. The Superior Court upheld it.
And we're going to go to the Anchorage Court. LIO at this time. And we're going to go to Robin Smith. And then after Robin.
My name is Robin Smith, and I want to thank the committee for allowing me this opportunity to testify against SJR 13. In 1973, Alaska was the third state in the union to establish the right of a woman to have an abortion. This right came before Roe v. Wade was heard in the U.S. Supreme Court. Women and churches from across the state worked to get the law passed. They did so because women died from having illegal abortions. Few Americans remember how bad it was before Roe v. Wade. Women from Alaska even flew to Japan to have abortions. A good friend of mine had an illegal abortion, but fortunately, when she started massively hemorrhaging, she was able to go to the hospital and receive multiple units of blood. She already had three children. Her death would have been devastating to her family. According to the Guttmacher Institute, 25% of women who will have an abortion, 25% of women will have an abortion before they are 45. 59% of women who have abortions are already mothers. Making abortion illegal does not make abortion go away. It only forces it underground and makes it unsafe. The best way to prevent abortion is to offer comprehensive sex education to all teens, free access to contraception, and 12 months of contraception when you get your insurance to cover your contraception instead of requiring a woman to get it 1 month at a time. None of this is available in Alaska, yet Alaska has the highest rate of sexual assault and rape in the country. Education could help this tremendously, but we don't offer comprehensive sex education in our state. According to the Guttmacher Institution, the U.S. abortion rate failed According to the U.S. abortion rate declined 14% between 2011 and 2014, reaching a record low comparable to the rate before Roe v. Wade. This evidence suggests that contraception and fewer unintended pregnancies played a larger role in the most recent declines than new abortion restrictions. Well over 60% of the decline in the number of abortions occurred.
I'm going to say thank you for your testimony at this time, Ms. Smith. We're now going to come back here to Juno, and we are going to...
Can I at least conclude?
No, ma'am, we can submit your testimony in writing. We would accept that as part of the official record. But at this time, we're now going to go here to Juno, and we will have the Reverend Caroline Malseed, followed by Rob Arnold.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Vice Chair, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. A lot of the talk about restricting access to abortions, restricting funding, is based on religious thinking, and so I want to talk a little bit about the teachings of my own church, the Episcopal Church, and also to talk about some biblical and social perspectives. In a series of statements over the past decades, the Episcopal Church has declared that we, quote, we emphatically oppose abortion as a means of birth control, family planning, sex selection, or any reason of mere convenience. At the same time, since 1967, the Episcopal Church has maintained its, quote, unequivocal opposition to any legislation on the part of the national or state governments which would abridge or deny the right of individuals to reach informed decisions about the termination of pregnancy and to act upon them. The church also, at the General Convention in 2018, that is our governing body, the Episcopal Church called for women's reproductive health and reproductive health procedures to be treated as all other medical procedures. The convention declared that equitable access to women's health care, including women's reproductive health care, is an integral part of a woman's struggle to assert her dignity and worth as a human being. We continue to advocate that the legislating abortions will not address the root of the problem. We therefore express our deep conviction that any proposed legislation on the part of national or state governments regarding abortions must take special care to see that the individual conscience is respected and that the responsibility of individuals to reach informed decisions in this matter is acknowledged and honored as a position of this church. I want to say that termination of pregnancy existed in biblical times. However, there's no biblical prescription against it, not a single one. Jesus said nothing about the termination of pregnancy, even though in his time it did occur. On the international scene, enforced pregnancy is a violation of international law and is considered a war crime.
You could wrap up your comments.
Okay. I just want to say laws against abortion do not prevent it, but result in unregulated and illegal abortions, death by hemorrhage or sepsis, and the risk of suicide by desperate, isolated women. So I ask you to seriously consider holding this legislation in abeyance and considering other alternatives to finding ways to reduce abortion in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. After Rob Arnold, we'll go to off-net to Sarah, Dr. Sarah Henneman.
Thank you, Chairman and members. I just want to say my name is Rob Arnold for the record. And, you know, there is a lot of debate on both sides. It's pretty heated. It's a political issue. I want to focus on our founding documents. According to the U.S. Constitution, we've been endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It does not specify born or unborn, but each person has these rights. I feel that personhood starts at conception and that our Constitution says we have rights. The state should have not impede on those rights and use appropriations to violate the U.S. Constitution. Therefore, the state of Alaska should not in any way pay for such procedures and uphold the U.S. Constitution, honoring each citizen's right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I just want to say that I'm also seeking to be on the board of the Juneau Pregnancy Resource Center. And at the Juneau Resource Center, we honor the mother, child, and the father. And we have resources to help them in any way possible, regardless of their choices or decision. It's a very affirming thing. It's a hard thing, and we do protect confidentiality in these cases. So I just want to thank you for taking the time, and I am for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Dr. Sarah Henneman, then followed by the off-net Wendy Perkins.
Good afternoon, Senator Wilson and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Sarah Henneman. I'm a family medicine physician, U.S. Air Force veteran, and a concerned parent. I have been practicing full-scope family medicine, including delivering babies in Alaska since being stationed at Eielson Air Force Base 13 years ago. I work at Capstone Family Medicine in Wasilla, committed to the well-being of our Alaskans, and I have no intention of ever leaving our amazing state. As a physician, I am allowed a unique and very personal window into the hearts and lives of my patients. My patients are burdened with the weight of many difficult situations, and I come home every day carrying a little bit of their pain, sadness, anxiety, and I have so many stories that I could tell you, and in the interest of time, I will omit the personal story I was going to plan for today, but know that it nearly ended in the death of a beautiful 15-year-old girl. When the parental notification discussion started a few years ago, I could see this girl's face. As my own children were becoming teenagers, I was so grateful that Alaska was starting to take a stand to protect our minors from ever being in a situation where they were supposed to choose consent and for undergo a medical procedure without her parents even being aware. As a physician, I understand that our teens have adult bodies, but that the frontal lobe of their brains is not completely formed till their mid-20s. And since that part assists with rational decision-making, suppresses impulsivity, the parents have a vital role in directing the paths that the teenagers take. The American Academy of Pediatrics has issued a policy statement noting that parents are better situated than others to understand the unique needs of their children and should be the appropriate caring decision-makers regarding their children's health care. Certainly, one can make the argument that not all the minors come from supportive and loving families, and some of them are in terrible abusive situations. Obviously, when there's a suspicion of abuse, I have a duty to report, as my primary interest is to protect those patients. But I was proud of my fellow voters for understanding the importance for families to, at the very least, be aware an abortion was performed on their family member. In the specific case I was going to refer to about that 15-year-old girl, she would have died due to delayed medical care because her parents were unaware she had an abortion. In more frequent cases, these young women are left to process through the grief and loss that nearly every woman will experience after an abortion. And
Dr. Henneman?
We take our most emotionally vulnerable and impulsive population, our adolescents and our teenagers, and expect them to manage this grief completely alone without the awareness of their primary support system.
Doctor,
but now there's a concern that
continue to
this is somehow
move
against
on
the
to,
state's constitution.
Next is going to be Wendy Perkins at the off-net, and then we're going to jump to the Fairbanks LIO to, Hayden Neville.
Hi, this is Wendy Perkins, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, and I represent myself and my family. And I know this is a really polarized subject, and I just want to ask everyone to just remain open-minded in this. And just back to what we're actually debating here. It's not necessarily abortion. We're just trying to talk about taking some of the out-of-control power away from the courts. And so I just wanted to reiterate the importance of protecting our minors as well, and then also just restating the fact that this is a human life that we're talking about. Now, I know I'm going back to the abortion issue, but ultimately I think that the end goal here is to eradicate abortion entirely. That is absolutely the end goal, but we're taking baby steps. I think this is a fantastic, absolute, no-brainer amendment. It's out of control what the courts have done. And any time, regardless of if you're really leftist or really rightist, whatever place you stand, you can get either liberal or extreme conservative judges on a bench and have our checks and balances system messed up. and it takes away the voice of the people. So I really want to just reiterate the importance of this amendment, just like one of the first speakers on this call, who happens to be extremely liberal-minded, if you will. So anyways, I just want to say that the times are changing. I am one voice in a new generation that is that sees killing unborn children is indeed murder. We are a new voice, and we're standing up. We are survivors of the tragedy of Roe v. Wade. And when you have a judge that can just interpret whatever he wants, whatever way he wants, you have a completely out-of-control system, and you have to go back and try to re-change laws. And it just puts so much more time and effort and strength on the whole system in general. Now, with my few seconds I have left, I just want to address some of the ridiculous arguments from the pro-abortion side, which are illegal abortions and, religion. Okay, so illegal abortions.
Your time is up.
So, do I not have any more time?
No, ma'am. We're going to go to the Fairbanks LIO to Hayden Neville next, and thank you for your testimony. And for everyone, please remember you can always send your testimony in writing to the committee. Hayden Neville, Fairbanks LIO, hello?
Anyone?
Not on mute. All right, in interest of time, we'll come back. We'll go to the Kenai LIO to Mariah Fahala.
Hello and good afternoon. My name is Moira Pahala, and I live in Soldotna, Alaska. And today, I am speaking on behalf of myself. Before I give the rest of my testimony, I would like to provide a trigger warning for those who have been victims of sexual violence and assault. As a lifelong Alaskan who was born and raised on the Kenai Peninsula, I know firsthand the challenges that many individuals go through in order to access their own healthcare decisions. I also know that Alaska, and specifically the Kenai Peninsula, have many community health concerns that remain unsolved. One of those ongoing issues is that the state of Alaska has the highest rate of sexual assault in the nation. I am but one of many survivors of sexual assault in the state of Alaska and on the Kenai Peninsula. Although the experience I had with sexual assault in my hometown was awful, I am extremely grateful that my assault did not result in me becoming pregnant. I know that others in my area have not been as fortunate and have had to result in forced birth or unwanted pregnancy. I can physically and emotionally not imagine how life would be different for me and drastically altered if my circumstances had been different. If in my situation I had become pregnant and had not had access to an abortion, I would have been 15, lost, stripped of my bodily autonomy, and all the opportunities my life has given me. I am certain in this case I would have not continued on with my education, would not have graduated college from UAA, and would not have been the community organizer and helper I am today. The fact of the matter is that SJR 13 does not end abortion. It just supports ending safe and legal abortions. If an individual is seeking an abortion and truly wants one, they will seek it regardless of whether or not it is safe, putting their lives at risk, which is not pro-life. The last thing that my community and state need are young individuals like me dying because they are victims of assault who cannot access their constitutional right to their own abortion. By putting SJR 13 forward, you are showing survivors like me that our lives don't matter to you, that if we are to become unwillingly impregnated, our futures don't matter to you. Abortion is health care, and at the end of the day, it is a vital resource to individuals like me.
Thank you for your
time. I am deeply
and
emotionally disturbed that my own Senator Merchiki would...
And go to Jonathan Fisher, followed by Luann McVeigh.
For allowing me to testify today. My name is Jonathan Fisher. I'm representing myself today, and I strongly support this resolution. I have three babies, and while my wife and I went through the pregnancy, anytime I would come into the room, the child inside the womb would get excited. They knew that daddy had come into the room. They would hear my voice, and so not only is there life inside that womb, but there's cognitive life. They have a memory. They know about their environment that they're in, and so it's not just about a heartbeat. It's not, but these are people with a memory. They can hear things. They understand things, and so it's so important that we protect these lives. And not only that, but I want to say that, you know, the fact that I have to fund an abortion is completely wrong. The phrase that comes to mind when I think of abortion is pure evil. This industry that makes money and uses these lives for the wrong purposes is just, it's pure evil. And the fact that I have to be a part of that through funding this, through my state, my taxes, I don't get a choice in this. I have to be a part of that. I might as well be in the room doing the abortion with that doctor because I'm putting my finances behind that, and I have no choice in this issue. And so I strongly support this resolution and hope that the chair will take some of these points and just consider that these babies, they have cognitive memory inside that womb, and they're important to us. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Luann McVeigh.
Thank you, Chairman Wilson, Vice Chair Imhoff, and Von Imhoff, and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I am opposed to SJR 13. I'm a retired teacher. I value human life. It's important to bring a child into an environment where she's wanted, cherished, and cared for. It's also important for a child's mother to be cherished and cared for and to have the choice of conception. When a woman conceives, planned or unplanned, it is her body, her choice, her right to bring that life into the world. If she's unable to properly care for a child, or for whatever reason, it is her body, her choice, to remove the cells within her uterus. Controlling one's body and one's health is a human right. That right should be protected in statute. And I wonder if this kind of legislation would even be considered if men were the ones who conceive the children. I just can't imagine that. It is wrong for the state, by denying abortions to women who need them in any way, to force women to bring children into this world for any reason. I'm opposed to the bill, and I hope that it does not go any farther than this committee. Thank you.
Thank you. We just want to thank everyone that testified thus far today, and everyone, we apologize. There's, like I said, we had over 100 folks here in the room in Juneau and on the phone to testify. We'll continue a testimony at another date next week. We'll look at the schedule and see when we can continue doing a public testimony. So please check the schedule for Thursday. With that, that's going to conclude our business for this afternoon. And if for folks who want to send in written testimony, again, shss@akleg.gov. On Friday, we'll hear an overview of Senate Bill 120, Administration Psychotropic Medication by Senator Giesel, and SB 179, Nurses License Multi-Compact by Senate Rules Committee on behalf of the governor. Again, for that bill, I know a lot of folks are going to be following along. We also encourage written testimony to be sent to be submitted, so we can include that into the packet and official record. And we are going to be adjourned at 2:58 p.m. Thank you.